I'd like to call this talk Silver Disobedience. I grew up in a part of the United States where one of the civil rights movements of the planet happened in the 60s, still in process. But the African American people sometimes would talk about, instead of civil rights, silver rights. In college, I did a paper on that movement, tying it to Gandhi. And I was so into the paper. I was in a college where you're not really supposed to learn anything. You're just supposed to memorize and say back what the teacher said. But I was really into the subject, so I was actually diving in and learning. And of course, it was too much to fit everything in. And I was at a free dance evening. And in the middle, there's a break, and someone guides something. And someone was guiding a circle, and we were supposed to bend over and then roll vertebra by vertebra back up. And I just passed out down on the ground from exhaustion and who knows what else. When I came back to consciousness, I thought I was in jail in Alabama, in one of the states next to my state. And I had dark skin, and the people around me had white skin. And it was not a nice place to be. And then luckily someone kind of touched my feet and said, think of somewhere that you feel good and imagine yourself there. And where I imagined myself was on a hill in England. So I'm telling a very convoluted story for fun. When I was a 10-year-old girl, my family came to England, and it was the Super Saver family tour. We were on standby, hours and hours sleeping on the floor. My parents with three children, sleeping on the Chicago airport floor, waiting to get called. But I just loved England. And there was one of those hills with the chalk horses, if you know them, the cutouts. So that's the hill that I went to 10 years later, in my imagination, and it helped. As we were coming in for the opening talk, my friend Rachel said, isn't it beautiful? Is this different from what you imagined or remembered of England? And I said, this is exactly how I remembered it, with all of that sweeping wide space. That kind of space, that kind of hill is what called me home in my exhaustion during my college years. And I remember on that trip with my family, Rachel said, you remembered it exactly like this. And I said, yes, except sometimes there were poppies, red poppies, in the fields. It wasn't only just green. And I remember looking out of the window of the rented little tin can car, nearly getting hit head on when my father went on the wrong side of the road. Which there hardly is room for two sides of the road anyway, and seeing the red poppies in the green field and being amazed and being happy. And just wondering why I was the only one being so amazed. There was a kind of doubleness happening in me, feeling very touched by what I was seeing. And such a clean cut right through to my heart, just seeing that field of red poppies. That it seemed impossible that we weren't all kind of slain by it. And now as a parent, I can easily, very, all too easily imagine what they were considering other than the poppies. Probably the fact that we were about to run out of gas, for example. And we had to coast down every hill to get finally just, we did manage to get to the, petrol station. So in that moment where I could feel myself just cut cleanly by what I saw, which wasn't just what I saw. It wasn't just the color. It was the aliveness that met me there. And then some part of me wondering, looking around somehow, isn't anyone else blown away by this? Or aren't you with me? Where are you? Even if we're about to run out of petrol. Even if we're lost and we can't ask directions. And it could have been a chance, if I had a little bit more confidence maybe, that I could have had an act of silver disobedience. Even if everyone else closes out the poppies. Even if those that I'm closest to are caught up in petrol and maps and how much does the hotel cost and can we manage, we have to stay one more week in London, can we afford it and all of that. So we can understand the parents, we can understand the adult concerns, and we can feel, understand, remember what the child knows. And I think we could leave room for the parents in the periphery. And we don't need to judge them. It's utterly understandable. It's utterly understandable that we take responsibility in the wrong way. We take it as the primary thing, instead of as what serves the center. The maps and the petrol and having enough money to get through the week at the Lime Tree Hotel is what serves being touched by the poppies by the side of the road that are not on any map. It would not be an act of silver disobedience to just then stop and say how wrong the parents were or how right the child was or how wrong the child was, etc. It wouldn't be an act of silver disobedience to stop. But to let that being stopped by what touches us, letting it really stop us, so that we fall into a kind of what one Zen teacher talks about as a silvery trickle of our way. We usually think of silver disobedience as the big battles. And that's why I love this play, this changing of the words from civil disobedience, civil rights, to silver disobedience, and can give us a chance of being stopped by the light on the bare floor, on the head. To let life stop us so that we drop into that silvery trickle that is not ours, that everything can serve. When we talk about child's play, we usually say it to say, oh, it's so easy, it's like child's play. And I love to watch how many different kinds of child's play there are. And there's one kind of child's play in particular that I'm very interested in. So it's not the really rambunctious, either overly tired or overly sugared or underly sugared or whatever. It's not that just burning off of energy, but very concentrated. Not so cerebral, but very concentrated, gathered. With Gyan, he does this with the cars, and he makes the noise. He's not three, and he can do this for, I think one friend said 47 minutes. Or suddenly then it's time to go make ice cream out of Anandi's fleece jacket and bring it to each person in the circle. And it is a game, and he knows he's just pretending. It's not that he thinks that it's really warm black ice cream. But if we say just pretend, then we're missing out on something that we know in our bones. Something, a lightness that moves us when we let ourselves be stopped. There's a poem by E.E. Cummings. Do you know him over here? I'd like to read most of it, if that's okay. The title is number 30, in case you care. The first line is, "One winter afternoon." And then in parentheses, so one winter afternoon, in parentheses, at the magical hour when is becomes if, and the end of the parentheses. So that magical hour, this magical hour, when is becomes if. A bespangled clown standing on 8th Street handed me a flower. Nobody, it's safe to say, observed him but myself. And why? Because without any doubt he was whatever, first and last, most people fear most. Should I read that part again? I'll start from the beginning, if you don't mind. I love this. One winter afternoon, at the magical hour when is becomes if. A bespangled clown standing on 8th Street handed me a flower. Nobody, it's safe to say, observed him but myself. And why? Because without any doubt, he was whatever, first and last, most people fear most. He was, without any doubt, whatever most people fear most. A mystery for which I've no word except alive. That is completely alert and miraculously whole. With not merely a mind and a heart, but unquestionably a soul. Dash. And then we're skipping some. A fine, not a coarse clown. No mob, but a person. And while never saying a word, who was anything but dumb, since the silence of him, self sang like a bird. Most people have been heard screaming for international measures that render hell rational. I thank heaven somebody's crazy enough to give me a daisy. Should it be read again? Or is it enough? Yeah. Beginning or middle? Without any doubt, he was whatever, first and last, most people, which he makes all one word. Without any doubt, he was whatever, first and last, most people fear most. And it's the colon, the 2 points. A mystery for which I've no word except alive. That is completely alert and miraculously whole, with not merely a mind and a heart, but unquestionably a soul. A fine, not a coarse clown, no mob, but a person. And while never saying a word, who was anything but dumb, since the silence of himself sang like a bird. Most people have been heard screaming for international measures that render hell rational. I thank heaven somebody's crazy enough to give me a daisy. So just yesterday, someone was speaking about feeling the need for another way of living that isn't just getting by, managing, surviving. She used the word managing, and I often use the word surviving. And also that isn't just giving up. I'd like to think about, with that question in mind, what is another way, or what is a way of living that's not surviving and not just giving up? Not just reacting to how exhausted we are from trying to get by. A question that comes to my mind is, what is laziness? And what is not laziness? When I went to one of my first and main teachers, Punjaji, in Lucknow in India, people were so relieved to hear him say, "Don't practice. Just experience what I'm helping you to experience yourself as emperor or empress of the universe, and then go live your life." People were so relieved to have someone tell them not to practice. And so they didn't practice. And then what happens is laziness. What happens is the tendencies live our lives. But what is true about this statement, don't practice? What is true about it is that usually the way that we try to practice keeps us from really practicing silver disobedience, from really coming to our wholeness with our alertness. Usually we put on our alertness and that breaks us, shatters us. It confirms the shatteredness of the mind and the heart. The faster we go, the slower we are. So one time, the same teacher who said, "Don't practice," and everyone felt relieved and stopped practicing. One time, I was just leaving India to go to the United States for a while. And he said, "What else would you want to do? What else could you possibly want to do?" So if that is not practicing, doing what else you could possibly want to do, there's nothing else you could possibly want to do. If that is not practice, or if that is practice, you can call it whatever you like, but please do it. That is silver disobedience. Without getting into the newspapers, without the drama. I would love for you to feel into yourselves, also now and also every day, what is not laziness? Can be confusing on a deep rest retreat when we're saying relax and rest. And really, we mean it. We really mean actually rest. Because what our laziness tends to be, tends to look like, is busyness. But at the root, what I find, the root meaning of laziness, what I find is the habit of believing our judgments the habit of judging, the habit of believing our judgments, and the shame that lies under that. The shame that we believe, buy into, that makes us willing to believe our judgments. What I mean by shame, I'm tempted to just leave you with that kind of grist. But maybe one example of what I mean by shame is an assumption that our experience is not quite what's described in a book or what the teacher is describing. We might then think, because our experience seems different from what we read about or heard about, we might then easily think that our experience is worse or better. We might easily believe that and then go from there. And going from there is a hellish way to live. So not just surviving, not just giving up, finding a way of living, finding a way, a silvery way to disobey not only our habits, but all of our customs. And even to disobey biology when that's getting in the way of our silvery stream of the heart. I can give a very fresh example in my own experience of how to let the preferences that are there be there without letting our preferences drive our life. I was just having a shoulder massage while I was preparing this Dharma talk, while a friend was playing with my son. It was very one of those afternoon sunlight experiences that usually never happens to me, by the way. And the adult, the parent, the responsible one would say, we have to leave at such and such a time to walk calmly to the meditation hall for the Dharma talk. And then the person giving the rub said, do we have 10 more minutes? And I looked at my watch and said, yes, we do. And I had a very helpful massage, not only for my body, but also for this talk. That's when the title came to mind, and I realized more clearly what I wanted to express. And then, just in the middle of that delicious experience, I knew it was time to go, even if the massage wasn't finished. And so we came, and we came jogging, which I like to do. So we can do something that looks wrong. It looks to go with my preference. It looks to then put myself in trouble because I have to run to give a Dharma talk, which could be ridiculous. Or it could be lovely, and it's lovely. If we hear that our preferences that we have agreed to live by, that we have received and agreed to, if we hear that those preferences are the only thing that keep us from seeing what is, it would be so easy to make them the enemy, or to make ourselves wrong or an enemy for having them, for having a preference to like to have a massage, for example. But it's not about getting into a battle in a simplistic way, but knowing how, by practicing, to tune into that silvery trickle that doesn't obey anything but its own freedom. And within that trickling way, we are included and the care of us is included. But it doesn't mean that because I follow my silvery trickle, everything is always looking very bright and shiny. So one important point for practice is to really feel the difference between when I feel excited or happy because what I prefer is happening and what I don't prefer is not happening. And another kind of connected, deep joy. That connected, deep joy that can be there and move us through everything. And I do mean everything. And there are human beings who have been in every kind of situation, letting this silvery trickle of disobedience live their lives. So what that means is we have that potential. We don't need to fear the future, because no matter what happens, no matter what circumstance, we can be disobedient. We don't have to obey the circumstances. There's a lovely moment in the story of the life of Gautam Buddha that I return to again and again. It would be like a moment in that poem by E.E. Cummings where suddenly you allow yourself to see that there is actually a clown who is crazy enough to give you a daisy. And the fact that the poet rhymes the two words really brings out exactly the feeling that I think is there. We think that what comes through in our silvery trickle, we think that it's silly. That is usually what we think. We think it's not serious enough. It's not what's in the book. So it can't be the real thing. So I just want to give this little glimpse of this one moment, this one turning point, this one suddenly seeing the bespangled clown with the flower. Even if no one else sees the clown. Even if you think it might be yourself who's the crazy one. So you may have heard a lot about the Buddha's life because now this information is much more available than it was 20 years ago. But he basically tried everything that was on offer, no matter how difficult it was. And basically what was on offer at the time were very difficult, painful practices, physically painful. And the first part of the slipping and being stopped by his experience, although in this case it wasn't a field of poppies, it was more of a desperate kind of situation that stopped him. He noticed that his body was almost about to die, and he had done everything that anyone could ever possibly do, ever, in his own words. And it hadn't really given him anything. In his words, it didn't give him any superhuman states. We might prefer to say it didn't bring out his humanity. And so in this beginning, if we can really hear the humanity of the Buddha for him, if we can feel our kinship with that, in that moment where we realize we may have wasted our entire life, or at least the last 6 years, putting our everything into something that gave us nothing, except a body that's about to die. So if we could first imagine or remember a moment like that, and feel how it could stop us. It could be an opportunity that we get stopped. And we remember this is our life. No one else has the same chance that we do to find a way for the life to be a beautiful life. If we cannot blame anyone in that moment but just be stopped, if we cannot get into the big battle but just be stopped, even if we are at the brink of despair, which we are in that moment, and we have been, I would wager that each one of us in the room has at least once been on the brink of despair. And if we could let ourselves slide into that silver disobedience so that it's not just, oh my God, I've wasted. I've given everything for 6 years and nothing has come to fruit. If we could let it stop us, and then the next sentence is, maybe there's another way. Instead of, why did those stupid teachers tell me to hold my breath until it hurt? Or why was I stupid enough to believe them? Which would be easy to think. If we can just let the being stopped be an alignment with that childlike place that remembers why we started that whole 6 years of doing pretty much crazy things in a different meaning of the word crazy. What was burning in us enough to sell ourselves to be obedient to that, that did not fit us, that we could have known from the beginning did not fit us, that now looking back we can see how from the beginning through the middle and to the end it never fit us, and we can remember how that feels. It doesn't fit. It's not the silvery, trickly way. That childlike place where there is the confidence to say maybe there's another way is usually missing, and that's where we could also, another point for practice, is practicing love for ourselves and for others, but especially for ourselves, so that the confidence can be there when we get stopped. So we get stopped by a field of poppies, and we can stay with it even if everyone else has other concerns. And if we get stopped by realizing we've wasted 6 years of our life, or 20, or the whole thing, if we could, when we get stopped by despair, not believe that we need to kind of charge ourselves and someone for it, for all the pain that we went through, and get on with what life is about. It's just a moment of strength that doesn't come from tension. It's a moment of strength that we can prepare for with love. So it's not just the guided meditations and the practice of loving kindness to oneself. It is also that, and I really recommend that if you connect with that kind of practice. Do it all day, do it on the bus, do it in the grocery store, do it while you go to sleep, and do it formally for an hour or two every day. I used to sneak into my room on retreat to lie down before I knew that there was such a thing possible to practice loving kindness while others were in the hall practicing something else. And it, for me, it's been very fruitful. So the moment where there's enough confidence that we can let not my own strength twist something, but let another strength come through us to say, maybe there's another way. It's a new thought that hasn't happened before. It's not the repetitive thought, it's a new thought. It's something with its own strength that we didn't have to add anything to. And it says maybe, first of all, maybe, not definitely. There's another way, a way that is unimaginable because we haven't seen it. We can't base it on the past practices. And then there seems to be another moment where we could trust our lightness. Maybe there's another way. Either out of desperation we have no other option, or because we really know that meeting of with the clown or the poppies is what is real life. We actually do know that. And trusting our lightness allows that kind of magnetic attraction for what is real to what is real to happen. And so in the Buddha's case, a memory came of a time when he was a child under a tree, probably in this kind of light, one winter morning. It wasn't winter, but whatever. Not this kind, not English winter. He remembered a moment where he felt happy. And it wasn't happy because he was getting what he wanted and not getting what he didn't want. That other kind of happiness. So if we could then accept that small gift, the possibility that there's another kind of happiness, that and that that's enough, and that that is what we practice. How do we practice something that we can't force to happen? We do whatever we can, giving whatever conditions are needed for now, from what is available, to more often be in that place of happiness, of uncaused happiness. So there, it's a funny, strange realm where we are kind of, in a way, trying to cause uncaused happiness. This is allowed. This is what spiritual practice is. Eventually, we get our wings and we fly, and it can be in any circumstance. But growing ourselves to the realization of the unconditioned requires certain conditions, and that's our job, to feel what those conditions are for ourselves and to give that in plenty. Are there any questions so far? So I'd like to read a few sentences from a woman named Mary Oliver, who's famous for her poetry. But this is supposedly not poetry, it's supposedly prose. And she's also talking about herself as a child when she would go into the forest and make buildings for herself, but she would do it alone. That was her way. She says, "For me, it was important to be alone. Solitude was a prerequisite to being openly and joyfully susceptible and responsive to the world of leaves, light, birdsong, flowers, flowing water." So, things that we can give ourselves, like letting ourselves go and make a little fort in the forest. Even if everyone else does it in a group, we want to do it alone. Other people put a door, we don't want a door. What is a prerequisite for our being openly and joyfully susceptible and responsive to the world of leaves, light, birdsong, flowers, flowing water? All these things that we could think of as trite. Most of the adult world spoke of such things as opportunities and materials. To the young, these materials are still celestial. For every child, the garden is recreated. And then the occlusions begin, then the blocking begins. The mountain and the forest are sublime, but the valley soil raises richer crops. The perfect gift is no longer a single house, but a house or a mind divided. And then she says, man, and I assume she means humans or we, so I'm going to say we, but she says man. We find we have two halves to our existence, leisure and occupation. And from these separate considerations, we now look upon the world. In leisure, we remember radiance. In labor, we look for results. But in those early years, I did not think about such things. I simply went out into the green world and made my house. a kind of cowl or a dream or a palace of grass. So our practice, or our non-practice, our silver disobedience, that silvery trickle that doesn't need to be a torrent. It's a silvery trickle. Is coming back to where we're not divided, or coming together in a way that is alert and whole. Without trying to be, without contrivance. So mostly it's about spending more time doing the things that we're basically afraid to do. We might not at first admit that we're afraid to do that thing or those things. I forgot in the Buddha story a very important third sentence, I think it is, where he thinks maybe there's another way and he remembers this pleasure. I said happiness, but it could also be translated really as pleasure, a pleasure that's not an addiction or about our preferences, a pleasure of aliveness. And then he says, Why should I be afraid of that pleasure? So he doesn't actually first say and admit, I am afraid of that pleasure. He says, why should I be afraid of that pleasure? Probably the later monks erased the line where he said, oh, I'm afraid of that pleasure. Why should I be afraid of that pleasure? Maybe that pleasure is my way. And it was. So coming back to where we are a house with one room, where we let our aliveness express as fully as a flower expresses its aliveness. In all its complexity. In all its unexpected beauty, beauty in unexpected ways. Disobeying in this silver way it's a really subtle difference, but also a radical difference. So with practice, feeling the difference between being moved by my ideas and my preferences and being moved by something that's scary and pleasurable. Or joyful. Sometimes we'll have to say, maybe this is my way. And sometimes we'll find out that it wasn't. And that's part of finding our way. So it's a subtle difference, but it's also a bedrock difference, a bedrock different way of living. Letting ourselves tremble before that radical disobedience that we're capable of. Leaning into its silveryness so that it's not like grunt work, so that it's not even work. And so we can hear Mary Oliver talking about what if we don't divide ourselves into the world of labor and the world of leisure, where there's radiance only allowed on one side. She talks about when we labor, we that is when we look for results. And so it's just a very simple and on paper obvious key. to investigate what moves me passionately and fully in a way that I forget to look for results. When we're not armed with results, with the idea of results, with statistics about our results, when we lay down the arms, the weapons, the armor, the kind of fundamental embarrassment that thinks we must have results in order to have the right to do anything. It can feel very alone in certain moments. We're in the car and we're the only one with the puppies. We're on 8th Street and we're the only one that sees the clown. Our friends reject us because we stop holding our breath until it hurts. There are those sort of eyes of the needles that we pass through and it feels alone, and it's another point for practice. Something to be ready for. Not to let the feeling of having to disobey opinions, disobey their opinions, their preferences, disobey my opinions, my preferences. If we could feel that something does bubble up and move us through the eye of the needle, and not allow the heaviness, the heavy thoughts of how I'm so alone and nobody else. If we can feel how actually in those moments we are often most receptive to something else lifting up, bubbling up, and passing us through the eye of the needle. Seemingly with nothing, unarmed, undefended. That seemingly poor. It's important to feel our extreme kinship once we pass through the needle, the eye of the needle. We actually could accommodate in our own heart everyone. We actually feel how we all can pass through, have had moments of despair and then remembering, this is my life. Maybe there's another way. Why should I be afraid of this way? This is my way. And a more literal kind of accommodating each other, each in our own unique ways and together, each with an unpredictable silvery trickle of a way of a life, letting us be different and together. So feeling that in a more kind of esoteric way, and feeling that in a very literal kind of way, a daily life kind of way, where we do make time to be with that person who also follows her or his silver, trickly stream, however different from our own. And we can feel the gravity of someone's being taken by their stream. That's what we need to be together with. More than we need bread. More than we need daisies, puppies, or anything else. Are there any questions or anything you'd like to say?
How would you begin to create conditions that lead to the unconditioned?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's very simple. Mostly it would be feeling what there's a childlike suggestion inside to do over and over again throughout your life. And when maybe someone close to you dies, you think, ah, you could give up everything else in your life and you're just going to finally go do that thing or not do that thing. So doing that thing or not doing that thing is the condition, one of the conditions. Yeah. And as our sensing grows in momentum, as our willingness to be taken by the silvery stream grows, what used to be hard to find time for has become the center of the life. There's no doubt. Like, I cannot brush my teeth today, but I could definitely not go out into the world without that practice or whatever. And it's good to know it's this beautiful, intricate complexity of a path. So it's some things get easier, but then the new challenges are integrated, are brought in. So in a way, it gets more challenging to do the simple thing that needs to be done. But we can feel that edge of trembling. It might not even be fear, but a kind of trembling with the aliveness of. So one image that comes to my mind many times, and the subject is someone on a retreat one time realized that playing the guitar was part of his practice, and his guitar was always in his closet with the door closed, and every day he would think how he could just get out the guitar, and every day he didn't. So those things, doing those things. And also, we could be, let's say, if we want a strict practice, our strictest practice could be not abiding in the motivation from trying to make myself better because I'm not okay. Not starting from that belief that my experience doesn't fit the book, something's wrong here, so I better hurry and fix that, and then maybe I'll live. So strictly not obeying that. So what that might mean is moment by moment falling in and out of being moved by fear, being moved by love, let's say. Being caught up in getting speedy and then getting exhausted and then dropping through joy or despair into that other thing, that other living, that trickly silvery thing. And what is needed most is more time in that trickling, silvery thing, whatever it looks like. So there's a text that I love called Yog Vashisht, where there's a woman that is describing her path, and she'll come to a place that there's a certain form that her silvery, trickly stream takes, so a certain kind of meditative state or practice. And she, in the text, it uses the word signs a contract. So she probably didn't actually sign, but inside signs a contract to spend as much time as possible in that. And then the next thing happens. Just when we thought she's about to get enlightened, no, deeper, wider. Yeah.
Well, if you only have a certain amount of time with someone,
yeah,
and you know that there is only a certain amount of time,
yeah,
and that might cause a pressure for you to,
yeah,
want to do lots of things with that person because you know that you might lose them.
Yeah.
How would you
yeah,
go with that?
The first thing that comes to mind is with time, we never know. So sometimes we do, it does look like we only have a certain amount of time with someone, whether they are dying or whether we are busy or whatever. And we never know. When we realize something is really important and most important, we might suddenly have more time together. But if there's a pressure, let's say that we know, it seems very clear that someone is dying, so we have weeks or months where we can visit, for example. It would be a beautiful way to feel when I'm in believing that something's not quite right and pressure, and then falling into, let's say, this is life. So if I could then, one way to fall in is to feel what I really want is a real communication or communion with this person in love. Just feeling that can help me drop out of believing in time and thinking that time rules. And then I can feel how this 1 minute with the person has an infinity to it, is enough, and this also next minute with this person. Also, we can, maybe it's easier to practice not with a person who's dying, where there could be so much emotion and then easily feeling pressure. But maybe for me, like with a tree, I notice if I let myself just be with the tree, even if I have only 5 minutes, or even we could limit ourselves to 5 minutes just for fun, and feel how much 5 minutes really with the tree, and not any particular way, just maybe, wow, the bark is really a lovely color in this light, and look at how that funny branch goes around like that. It doesn't have to be silent communion necessarily with, it could be very simple. But 5 minutes still fills me. I remember this one time I played 5 minutes with the pine tree. I don't even like pine trees, supposedly. I still can feel the pine tree with us. So it can help us where we don't believe in time, and we can meet in a deeper place that does continue also. And we can really, in a simple human way that's not trying to be more than it is, appreciating the hand, the breath, the last breath. The chance for that situation to kind of cut through us like the poppies did to me when I was 10. To really bring us where we know obviously what is important. We know obviously what life is, no matter what anyone else says. And to be blown away by that. So it's not, it's simple, but it doesn't, it leaves unpredictability. It doesn't put everything in order and necessarily happy. But a clean cut to the heart, where we know what life is. Is that? So let's have just a moment or two quiet together. You don't need to jump into lotus position or whatever. Just a couple of moments silent and then the walking. May we follow the trickling silver stream of our lives, resting into the silveriness, letting it be just a simple trickle that no one can predict where it will go next. May our sincerity in this gathering here contribute towards a momentum of liberation everywhere.